Electricast.
Seems that there was so much thought put into each character and what they would listen to, what they would respond to, and what it tells about the characters is amazing, because it's not just like, here's some songs that they're dancing to. It's giving you insight and bringing you deeper into the film.
Welcome to Sync Lounge, sponsored by Sync Floor, a podcast where we get to chop it up about film, music, and production with experts from across the media landscape. The pairing of film and music is an inspiration to creatives everywhere. And today we have the great fortune of discussing the magic of those pairings with a talent whose discerning taste has influenced award-winning productions for over a decade. With a list of supervision credits that include Flint Town, Crip Camp, and Love and Tosha, Amine Reamer has demonstrated that taste and talent time and time again. For this episode of Sync Love, Amine has chosen Pretty in Pink as the film we'll be discussing, and I couldn't be more excited to dig in. Amine, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So I've got something very, very, very important that I want to get out on the table right here at the start. Are you going to make me sing?
No. Are you going to make me sing? Because I cannot.
So I've been like totally prepping for this. I'm like, okay.
I will make you sing.
Like, I'm going to have to be ready to sing if she says that I have to sing. You know, and I think I know what it is I'm supposed to sing.
can we insert the songs themselves at the later point?
Well, okay. So at a later point, we'll see how things are going. And if singing is called for, I've got something to throw in. So we'll see how it goes. All right. So now, before we get into talking about music and picture, how are things in New Zealand?
Fantastic. It does feel like another world. But I'd say anything I say, I'm just going to feel like an asshole, because I just came from 10 months in LA, and I know
the anxiety and the suffering.
So yeah, I'm not going to rub it in. I am very grateful and lucky that I was allowed to come home, and it has been kept at bay, and people, for the most part, are pretty oblivious to what it is like in the rest of the world.
Right. Welcome from New Zealand. So before we get into Pretty in Pink, I'd love to talk a little bit about some of the work that you've done. And one of the things that you said to me when we first spoke really stuck with me. Something along the lines of the work you do can be for the meals or for the reels. I don't know if you remember.
That is my saying.
That is your saying. And you're so talking about balancing the need to feed your soul and to feed your stomach. And, you know, in the context of films with the pedigree of Flint Town and Crip Camp, can you talk a bit about how you got involved in those projects and how you balance the need and the desire?
Yeah, well, for Flint Town, I had previously worked with Peter Morgan, who was the producer. So the work that I would say for the reels that actually am more than happy to be a part of. And it's often, you know, letting your agent know it doesn't matter, you're going to do it anyway. It's referral. It's working with people. But I think it's having a passion for the work. Like, when it is hard, when you don't have the budget, when you are, instead of going in for library tracks or what's obvious, because you don't have the money, finding things in different ways. Like, I don't think I'll ever forget in Flint Town having to actually write letters, pen and paper, because a lovely elderly gentleman in Flint had written a song in the 60s that we found that we wanted to use. He was generous enough to let us use it for our measly budget, which was the same as paying what would be paying for a library check. Mm-hmm. But figuring out how to download a PDF and faxing was even like the future for this guy. Talking to him on the phone, writing a letter, sending a self-addressed, you know, envelope back, signers, you know.
Making it easy.
And you find yourself doing those things when you're like, this project is worth it, like whatever I can do. And it was the same with Crip Camp. I think I was on it close to 2 years. So it does become sort of community based in a sense, where they're like, okay, this person we know will give it 110%. Not that I don't have my For the Meals project, but it is difficult.
Yeah. Fair enough.
It's like,
I remember you brought up Crip Camp there, and I remember you talking about fighting for sort of the least known song that actually ended up becoming the best loved song by the director. And it felt like what you were saying was that ultimately you almost are in this battle for the soul of the film as it relates to the music that you were trying to make happen and getting the people, even the people in the crew, to really appreciate a particular direction. And I'm curious how you approach that part of the process.
Well, I first have to change my own mindset to it not being a battle, but getting people on side, because ultimately you're there to fulfill the director and or the producer's vision sonically at how they see the film going. But I think as the supervisor, part of your job is to be an advocate for the project. Even if it is the producer and the director's vision, if you're looking at a scene, you have to come at it with, okay, what would work best in this project, taking into account what they want, what you think would work, what your budget is, all of these factors, and then trying to get that message through to the people on your team who often might go, actually, I don't see it that way at all. This was my favorite song from high school, and I want that. And you're like, but this scene is not that.
It's not that.
It's like, let's look at the people in the scene and what that actually goes with the bigger picture, and trying to communicate those things in a way that you can actually be heard. So yeah, like with Like a Ship, that was something that for me, there was a lot of civil rights era songs that I wanted to get in, but also had to fit the tone and what was comfortable for the filmmaking team. And that's luckily spoke to them as well, but they didn't know where it was going to go. So the scene with the Black Panthers are helping them, I was like, and they came up with putting it at the end credits as well. So it's like they fell in love with a song as they had it for a longer amount of time. And it's one of those moments where you sort of just smile and go, I introduced something new, something different. Yeah. I won't say what song was going to be in the end credits that we weren't sure we were going to get, because we were like 6 months in just trying to get past labels, publishers, managers to the person. Eventually we did, and they're both in there now. But yeah, it is one of those things where the fight that I saw the filmmakers have for this project inspired me not to give up as well.
Yeah.
Trying to make it the best it can possibly be.
Yeah.
But I'm so, so grateful that I was able to be part of that, because I had no idea when I first started on it what a story that was.
Yeah, and it was a pretty amazing film, and the music was really well-crafted and chosen. So hats off to you.
Thank you. Thank you. Honestly, I can't think of anything else that I had to not fight, but really, really push to get over the light.
Yes.
And it was worth it. Yeah.
No, that's fair. No, I get it. And well, you know what made me think a lot about that discussion we had in the context of Pretty in Pink, actually, was that I think the director, Howard Deutsch, I think he was going to go in a different direction. He was going to go in like a theme song direction with the soundtrack. And John Hughes convinced him to go with, you know, what we all know and love as that sort of post-punk new wave kind of direction for everything, which became a classic. And so I kind of imagine the conversation that they're having, right? Two strong personalities trying to decide on what's this musical symbol, right, for the film.
But I think it's like John Hughes, because it was in 86. It was after Breakfast Club and 16 Candles. Mm-hmm. So I would say that would be a pretty hard battle to say, I've got a better idea. It's like, I don't know if you've got a good track record with music and film, you know.
No, but he could have been, look, John, that's been there, done that.
but that's why I think Pretty in Pink is actually better than 16 Candles and Breakfast Club, because he had songs written for the film, like If You Leave and Echo and the Bunnymen, Bring on the Dancing Horses. To think that those songs didn't exist before the film, they were specifically written for the film. John Hughes one-upped himself with Pretty in Pink. Just the new wave. It's within that soundtrack, I think every sort of different teen is represented. The fact she works in a record store that is cool. And it's like, you look at Ducky with the Smiths and Please Let Me Get What I Want.
I'm so glad that you bring that up, because later on I was going to talk about, you know, favorite scenes. And I have two of them, and they both involved Ducky. But that particular scene, and in particular the music choice for Please, Please Let Me Get What I Want, please let me get what I want. It was so soft touch. Like, it was barely a whisper of just that refrain for just like 10 seconds, maybe. You know what I mean? And it was so, it says so much. And it was, oof.
But it's like, you think about it at the time, like 86, yes, the Smiths, you know, heyday maybe, but in America, they weren't mainstream, and in the soundtrack, it isn't just one type of music. And I think it's such a good representation. Mm-mm. I mean, yes, there's the Smiths and New Order, but there's also like in the record store, it's...
Otis Redding.
Yeah, Try a Little Tenderness.
Actually, that's the other one. That's the other scene. I was just like, oh.
Yeah, it has everything. I mean, obviously, new generation can hear those songs and not think of the film. But for me, it's such an inspiration to go, not only was the music taken so seriously as such an important part of the film, but they started making the songs before the film. And everyone says, oh, music's so, so important. But the fact they actually put their time and effort and thought into getting the right songs, getting songs made is amazing. And obviously, I don't know what the budget was back then, but I'm guessing...
It probably wasn't huge.
Yeah, but I'm guessing it was substantial enough that they're going to value it as an equally important character in the film as if they were hiring a person. So yeah, I think John Hughes would have won that argument. Like,
yeah, that's fair.
And I think he's the one that went out to get those songs made. And just the boldness of having, if you leave, I think it plays for something close to 10 minutes at the end.
The wacky thing about If You Leave, right, the story behind that with the original ending not testing well. So they had to reshoot the ending and go get that song made. I think they made that song in like 24 hours because they just didn't have much time to just go, okay, well, you need something new. that's just wild.
Just to think of how that would have changed their career. Well, I mean, they were already an amazing established band, but after the film came out and that song, and how when people heard that song, the emotion that it brought or the memories that it brought from that time. Mm-hmm. I haven't talked to OMD, but I would think it would be somewhat career changing, or at least brought them to a new level.
I think so too.
Worldwide.
Soundtrack for a generation.
Suzanne Vega, left of center.
Yes.
That's just, I love that everything for the soundtrack fits together, but totally doesn't fit together, because you wouldn't put Suzanne Vega with Try a Little Tenderness or the Smiths or John Lennon in excess track
that people would normally like think of with an excess.
Exactly.
It's so great.
Yeah. When I got into music supervision, the question would be asked like, oh, you know, what's your favorite soundtrack? And I used to want to have a different answer than Pretty in Pink, like something like really intellectual and arty and unusual and, you know, obscure even. But I just think this is such a beautiful example of the collaboration that must have occurred between the filmmakers, the musicians, the bands, even the label who's deciding to put out the soundtrack. Okay. I would think they would have taken a step back because these songs were written for the film. This was John Hughes putting his vision into it. And it being so successful and not being like top of the pops chart, the song choices, like I think, wouldn't it be good? I think came out 2 years before the film. Mm-hmm. You know, he wasn't concerned with is it coming out now? Was it a huge hit?
Not at all. Yeah. You know, like Pretty in Pink itself, right? You know, that's
1981.
You know, it was at least a couple of years before, right?
So it's ultimately what is best for the project? Who are these characters? What mm-hmm. would they listen to? What is this song what saying motivates about? Them? Yeah. Yeah. And so it seems that there was so much thought put into each character and what they would listen to, what they would respond to, and what it tells the audience about that person, about the characters is amazing, because it's not just like, here's some songs that they're dancing to, both lyrically yeah. and musically. It's giving you insight and bringing you deeper into the film.
That's right. And give you access to their thoughts. It's really, you know, you had this same struggle. I remember when we asked you what film you wanted to pick, you were like, well, you know, I should pick this or that. And you kept being hesitant. I was like, well, what do you really want to pick? And you're like, well, I want to actually pick Pretty Pretty Pig. And we were all like, yeah, that's awesome. Let's go for it.
Obviously, Rushmore's a great soundtrack and I love all the songs, but I don't know if I could talk as passionately about it. But I do think Pretty in Pink over even other John Hughes films, like for me, it's like the penultimate use of music in films. And because Psychedelic Fur is Pretty in Pink was already out, but like opening it with seeing Andy on the wrong side of the
tracks, yeah,
kind of thing. And it's like, and Pretty in Pink, like the sort of juxtaposition, not only visually, but musically, just how they sound. And they don't sound like a sweet, happy pop band.
That's right.
Pretty as
right.
Pink, you know, and, right. and everything was, just even talking about it, I'm like, oh, I guess we should.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's really great. And I'm curious how you would describe some of the projects you've done and how this film impacted your approach to supervision.
The goal for me is, who is that person? You know, the character, whether fictional or not, who is that character? What is the scene? What are you trying to convey? Are you going with the character? Are you going with the wider scene around them that you're trying to explain inner thoughts, or you're trying to expose what's actually happening outside of them? So it's all these different angles that music can convey, and the importance of it, whether it's score or a song. What are you saying? What emotion, what tone, what message are you saying with the music? And sometimes it's the music is sitting in the background because it doesn't need to be elevated through. You want them to sit in silence. It's always an emotional place that I start out with. What is it that we're trying to say? What is it we want the audience to feel? And then going, what are our options within that palette? You know, and then it's like budget and it's... and you've got like a producer, a director, a co-executive producer, and everyone's got, you know, a different take, a different opinion. And as the supervisor, you're taking on all of that as well. And then hopefully having a really amazing collaborative discussion about what you want to achieve. So I imagine, and it is in my imagination, but I imagine that was the process for Pretty in Pink, where it was everyone in a room discussing what they're going for, getting the songs made, and it being a true idea of everyone's on the same page of what they want for that scene, for that character. What are they trying to say? That's where I'd like to start my projects from. And depending, obviously, on what they are and who's involved, like sometimes your job is actually, you've been given that list where they're saying, these are the songs we want, these are the scenes we want them in. And your job is to go and negotiate and get them. And that's when I say for the meals, like for the real, when it's a true collaboration, where your idea about the character, what you're trying to convey, the emotion, you're part of that process. And that's kind of living the dream when you get a team who you can have those discussions with.
Yeah.
I love everyone I work with, but a while back I worked with a director, Jamie Travis, who I think had excellent taste in music. And he also thought I had excellent taste.
Yeah, there you go. It's all good.
Because I liked really well. And it's like, a lot of the ideas would be his and a lot of the ideas would be mine, but would come to a good place because it was based on the scene and the characters and the motivation and what you want the audience to feel. And that excitement just makes the whole job worthwhile. Wow. Get to work with people who it is truly collaborative.
Yeah. You kind of set up my next couple of questions here with talking about Your process said it's great. It's awesome. I love it. So you and John, you're in the room. You got piles of records around. You're thinking about what you got to make happen here. This is about a soundtrack for a generation. You know, there's a lot of feeling about the kind of music that was put in here. Do you feel like there's anything that is missing? Would you tell him, hey, how come we didn't get this in here?
Well, I think it was all pretty covered, including when they go to the club and it's a totally different kind of music. And the question I would have for John that I would love to ask him is, why not Nick Kershaw's version of Wouldn't It Be Good? And I think he had that covered. I don't think the cover already existed of Wouldn't It Be Good by Three Dog Night. But I was like, was that a nod to a previous generation? Because this came out in 86 and Three Dog Night was late 60s, early 70s. Like, I would want to know the thought process behind, because the song, I think, is amazingly appropriate for the film. You know, what it would be like to be in someone else's shoes, like she's imagining being rich and popular, that sort of stuff. And I would think vice versa, to have that freedom for Blaine. You know, the richer for him to not have those concerns and that weight of the appropriate social status. So, yeah, I would be so curious to know why not the original. Because the song is perfect, but why did you...
Yeah, why that one? Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
All right.
Please tell me.
So you're like, I've been wondering for a long time. So then here's a second one. So as we talked about a little bit before, this wasn't the original ending that ended up being in the film. So let's say it was the original ending. It's Ducky ends up with Andy. And what would you choose as a song for that ending?
Wow. That's, not at all prepared. Wow, what would I choose? Yeah, I don't know if I'd actually go for another Smith song, There's a Light That Never Goes Out, because that's like To Die By Your Side there.
Yeah, you know, okay. Yeah, I feel
that would be, because that would be from Ducky's perspective.
Yeah, yeah.
But I agree the ending needed to be changed. But, or something really celebratory, just like straight up.
Straight up, yeah.
Happy, yeah. Like big, like if you'd go even like Motown, because Ducky is obviously like how we dress and maybe the Faces, Ooh La La, like go
La La. Yeah, that feels appropriate to Ducky, because I think if they ended up together, it was a celebration of sort of Ducky's personality and goofiness and charm winning her over.
Yeah,
you know, finally. But so there's a really weird piece of trivia that I found that I'm curious if you came across this. So the bouncer at the club was Andrew Dice Clay.
I did not know that.
Yes, it was Andrew Dice Clay. And Andrew Dice Clay had this bit he would do in his comedy routines where he'd go, oh.
I grew up in New Zealand, in my defense. So
that's like, fair enough.
Yeah.
But this is the bit he would do. But it turns out that that exact bit is the thing that's sampled for EMF. Their song, it's him doing that. So that, oh.
Wow. You know, it's I did not know that. That's amazing.
Weird stuff.
That's a deep dive. That is a super deep dive.
So that's the piece of trivia I'll leave you with. And what I'd love to hear from you is, and I know all our listeners would love to hear this, is what are you working on now?
A few things. I am working on the upcoming TV show for Apple, Shantaram, based on the book. Very, very excited about that.
Right. And when does that land?
I think we're a fair ways off because we are starting filming in a couple months. I am currently in post on 6 music documentary.
Wow.
For The Ringer, and they'll be on HBO, and
awesome.
They're all fantastic. And the ones I'm currently like deep in now, Woodstock Ramble Roaring, which is so fascinating. and lucky enough to be working again with Garrett Price, who was the director for La Bantosha.
Nice.
That means
nice.
Directing that one. Alanis Morissette, a doc about her.
Nice.
A doc about Kenny G, which is so interesting. It is so interesting. Yeah,
I have a Kenny G story that I'm going to have to tell you offline sometime.
I definitely want to hear. And then an amazing doc about Robert Stigwood and his influence on the music scene at the time, disco, like RSO Records. He was a person behind the Bee Gees, Yvonne Tillman, Jesus Christ Superstar, Tommy, Grease, Saturday Night Fever. So that one's pretty intense and fantastically interesting. And the other two we haven't quite kicked off on yet, Juice WRLD.
Oh, wow.
So a doc on Juice WRLD.
Wow, what a slate. What a
slate.
Yeah. you are very, very busy.
There is always more time because that's, I live and breathe music and music supervision. And,
well, thank you for sharing that. That sounds amazing. Can't wait to get to see and hear those projects.
Yay. Yeah. It's me too.
So we have a thing that we do at the end of each of these episodes where we ask our guest to tell us about a scene, who's a pairing of music and picture, that always gets you.
You could have sent me that question like a day, a week before.
Yeah, but it's no fun then.
Yeah, but it's like immediately my brain just went 100% blank. Like I'm like, what? There are a couple. Actually, I would say The Creation in Rushmore. That always makes me happy when I hear it. Like every time it doesn't get old.
There you go. All right. Well, gosh. Avina, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for sharing so much of yourself and your thoughts and being so fun to talk to on the show. And thank you for being here with us.
Thank you. These are my favorite type of conversations. So
excellent. Excellent.
Thank you.
We'll do it again sometime. And I will sign off. I am your host, Kurt DeBeek, and this has been another episode of Sync Love. Until next time, keep listening to the movies. Sync Love is a co-production of Sync Floor and Electrocast Media. On our next episode, Heather Boyd tells us how Cameron Crowe's Vanilla Sky inspired her career in music supervision. Our producer is David Tausig. Our executive producers are Mark Netter and Peter Rafels. Our editor is Cam Castro. Special thanks to Sync Floor artists Naka and Mokov and Sync Floor partner Motor Music for their musical contributions to the show, as well as designer Jeremiah Whitaker for our Synclove cover art. Please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you like this show, give us a rating and tell your friends. Until next time, I'm your host, Kurt DeBeek. Keep listening to the movies.
Electricast. Hey, it's Tim from 50 Years of Music with 50-Year-Old White Guys, the comedy podcast you had no idea you needed. Join Ben, Jeff, and me as we continue our musical road trip back through the years and around the globe. See, just when you thought all white guys were like Joe Rogan, you come across three educators trying to remember when we were cool.
50 Years of Music with 50-Year-Old White Guys.
Electricast.
Welcome to Sara Talk Solutions. Ladies and gentlemen, you've tuned into a bit of a different type of show. I'm Sara B and I'm your host. You can find me on my IG, which is Aussie_Sara_LA. I talk about amazing, relevant conversations and topics and what functions that goes on in this magical, wonderful, wonderful city of the City of Angels. My IG, which is Aussie_Sara_LA.